Welcome to the next session on the book of Ecclesiastes here. We're looking at Ecclesiastes chapter 5 in the last session. We're going to continue on. We left off in verse 7. So our journey begins in verse 8. If you have your Bible, turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 8, please. What Solomon is going to do is he's going to focus now on money. He's going to focus on wealth and all the issues that come from money in life, especially if somebody making money or earning money or gaining wealth, becoming rich. If that is their goal in life, well, he says, you got another thing coming. We'll see what he says here. Beginning in verse 8, if you see the oppression, so here he's bringing back up this idea of oppression, because gaining wealth and oppression, they go hand in hand in his mind. In order to gain wealth, a lot of times people will oppress others. They will exploit them. They will take money from them because they have the power and the other people don't, and therefore they can abuse their power by exerting it to get what they want from people who are beneath them. If you see the oppression of the poor and the denial of justice and righteousness in the land, do not be amazed at the situation. Solomon's saying, if you see all this bad stuff happening, oppression of the poor, denial of justice, if you see injustice, if you see people who should be punished, but then are being released and let go, if you see righteousness being suppressed in the land, don't be surprised. Don't be amazed that this is happening. Why? He says, for one authority watches over another authority, and there are higher authorities over them. While individuals can oppress others, Solomon is now actually looking toward a larger scale oppression and form of injustice. He's proclaiming one that is so widespread that it's caused by corruption that exists within a structural hierarchy of government. The people here who have authority, these are rulers. These are people who are in positions of political power. He's saying that there's a structural hierarchy by which people with authority watch out for or look out for others with authority. And the people over them look out for them. And this is the way that this oppression and injustice is perpetuated. And often corruption is then allowed to exist and remain because it is at multiple levels in that organizational hierarchy. Each person watching out for others so that they can continue their oppressive regime and that it can remain in effect and they can be able to receive the wealth, the advantage, and all the other things that serve their self-interests from it. Does this observation of Solomon really come at any surprise to us? I don't think so. In Solomon's time, he saw this happening, but this has been the course of history forever. This is what people of every culture have done, especially when it comes to political power. Now, the corruption might be in different forms and to different, maybe some different degrees in one culture versus another, but people who are in power do whatever is necessary to keep that power and to use that power to their advantage and accomplish their desires. I remember hearing about some of the corruption in other nations. Timmy Paul, you shared a little bit with me about some of the corruption that exists in the Congolese government. You get stopped by a police officer and they ask you for a bribe. Well, that police officer doesn't get in trouble. Why? Because the captain of the police force is also corrupt. And he doesn't get in trouble because the governor of the region is also corrupt. And he doesn't get in trouble because the president, maybe, is also corrupted. The multi-level scheme works to allow people to remain in power and then abuse that power for selfish gain. And so this is the problem that Solomon sees here. Now, verse 9, he says, but in all, an advantage for a king is this, or an advantage for a land is this, a king for the sake of agriculture. This is actually a very complicated and difficult verse. This is a positive sort of translation and interpretation of it, but it could also be viewed from a negative point of view as well. And there are good reasons for that. The translation would go something like this, that the profit of the land is taken by all. Even the king benefits from the field or from the agriculture. And so then the meaning of the verse would then be that while all these people in authority are using their power to oppress others and they're protecting each other's back, that even the king benefits from the work of those underneath of him. And that it seems like all the value and all the gain ends up flowing upward to the people with power. That would fit a little bit better in the context because Solomon's talking about this use of power in a very negative way. And that really wouldn't seem to exclude the king because he doesn't have a very high view of the way that the king functions. The king is actually part of the problem. And he sees himself, who's described as being a king, as being involved and witnessing all this that's going on and not doing anything about it. So I think seeing that this is probably more in line with a negative view or a negative interpretation seems to fit better with the overall point that Solomon is making here. Now, in the next few verses, from verse 10 to verse 15, he's going to launch into a series of statements, essentially reasons why wealth is dangerous and why wealth is a problem. There are seven reasons that he's going to give. Now, we're going to go through them, and then I have a summary slide at the end to recap them. But verses 10 through 15 deal with the problem of wealth and what it brings. So the first problem, verse 10, the one who loves money, essentially the person who's greedy, will not be satisfied with money, nor will the one who loves abundance, meaning abundance of like income or abundance of money, be satisfied with his income, with what he gets. This too is pointless. So the first reason that money is a problem is he says, well, wealth is both addictive and unfulfilling. Greed is never satisfied. There's always room for more. I think the question to ask is, well, how much more? How much is enough? You can ask yourself, do I have enough money? If you say no, well, then what number would actually then turn your answer to a yes? Most people would probably say no. No matter how much money they have, they probably think they'd be better off with a little bit more. The problem is that money will actually never satisfy no matter how much you have. But we inside of us in our brokenness and the way that the world is, there's always a desire for more money. Therefore, whatever goal you might set for yourself in life, if you have financial goals, you have to understand what Solomon is saying here is that it is never going to be complete. You're never going to find that you've come to the measure that you wanted to get at, and then you're just like, that's great. I feel completely content and satisfied. No, he's saying that once you get there, you're going to set your sights on something a little bit higher. I think there are a few things that we can truly say that people are never satisfied with. And one is money. I think another one is power. And then you could probably also lump pleasure in there as well. I was reading an article that was published by The Atlantic, and it reported that the more successful and wealthy that people become, they actually tend to work more. This is particularly noticeable in elite men in business. It seems to be like a backwards phenomena that from what we might expect. We might think if somebody gains success and wealth, that they then sort of like cut back a little bit. But no, these elite men in business, they say they, among more than any other category of demographic, invest themselves more in their work. Why would they do that? I think it's probably because they want whatever else there is to get. And there's always something else to get, isn't there? There's always something else to strive for, something higher. There's always some more lofty ambition than what you currently have. There's always just another rung on the ladder, one step up. And there will be another one above that as well. The second reason begins in verse 11. Solomon says, when goods increase, so when you get more material, those who consume them increase. And what advantage is there to the owner except to look at them with his eyes? There's actually a kind of a combined second and third reason here. That the second one here is that, well, when you get more goods, when you get more wealth, then there's also a corresponding increase in the people that consume them. And along with that, he says, the third reason that is, well, what advantage is there to the owner? And the question implies a negative answer. Well, there really isn't any, except for him to look at them with his eyes. What Solomon is trying to describe here in a very terse way is that the person who increases in wealth then usually naturally increases in the labor force that is required in order to sustain that wealth. These are the people who consume his wealth. The possessions of an owner might multiply, and therefore he must hire additional help to manage them. And so he grows wealthy, but as his wealth is produced, then also it's then turned over and given to those who work for him. And so because of this natural consequence that accompanies the accumulation of wealth, the owner doesn't actually get to enjoy any of the wealth. He gets the wealth, and then he hands it off to the people who help him obtain the wealth. It's a vicious cycle, and that the fortune that he amasses is met by a large household and large expenses then in order to manage the provisions he needs to keep running his business. And therefore, the owner finds no advantage for himself. The fourth reason, verse 12, the sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of the wealthy person will not allow him to sleep. The fourth issue with money is that it causes you to sleep bad. You can't sleep. The premise that Solomon's arguing from is that the rich don't sleep well. And he's saying that because of the wealth that they have. Now, what does wealth have to do with not sleeping well? Wouldn't having a large fortune seem to maybe put your mind at ease and you could sleep soundly at night? One might think so, but he doesn't explain the mechanism behind why he's making this case. I think maybe we could say it's perhaps because rich people are always concerned about their money, what to do with it, how to multiply it or get more of it, what happens if they lose it, and so on. The endless possibilities also of having money in order to do projects, to make purchases, to own property, they surround the wealthy person every day, and they follow him into the night, where they do not permit his mind to be at rest and thereby enjoy sound and rejuvenating sleep. I was reading an article that I found from the New York Times. It's about a guy named Thomas Gallagher, and the article is called "I'm Rich, and That Makes Me Nervous." Oh, I'm sorry, anxious. That makes me anxious. Thomas Gallagher, he was on Wall Street when he was young, and he's a multi-millionaire now, over the age of 70, and retired, lives a life of leisure, you might say. But he doesn't find it so leisurely, he says. This is what he says is, he's a multimillionaire, but even so, I still feel to some extent that I don't have enough money. Emotionally, he says, I don't come from money. I got very lucky on Wall Street. I've been dealing with a myriad of psychological issues since I retired. I have more money than I ever imagined, but I still worry. Do I have enough? If I live longer than I thought I would? I think he's trying to express, I think, what Solomon's getting at, is that people who have money, they have troubles. Troubles that money bring. Having money, in the way that Thomas Gallagher is expressing, is that, well, when you have money, and the things that you used to worry about, maybe you don't worry about anymore because you have money, but now you worry about your money. You stay up at night thinking about your money, what you're going to do with your money. What happens if you don't have enough money? And then you have to change your lifestyle. What happens if you get robbed? These are the things that preoccupy rich people. And Thomas Gallagher is trying to testify to that as just a case example. All right, the next reason, I'm going to go on to verse 13. This will be the fifth reason that Solomon gives about the problem of pursuing wealth. He says, there's a grievous evil that I've seen under the sun. Yeah, this is a new term he's using, grievous evil. He's trying to just emphasize just how bad he thinks this particular issue is with wealth. And what he says here is the grievous evil that he has seen under the sun is wealth kept by its owner to his harm. Wealth that is kept by his owner to his harm. You might ask, how does keeping your wealth, how is that harmful to you? I mean, aren't we supposed to save money and be able to then, that's the way you accumulate wealth is you save your money. But that then turns out to be bad for you? In what way, Solomon? It appears that Solomon has in mind someone who's accumulating money simply for the sake of it, meaning that they are keeping the money to themselves solely so that they can have money, so that they can have a big number on their bank account, as though that is the end objective for why they're just hoarding all this money to themselves. He doesn't specify why he sees this behavior as being really detrimental to the owner, but we could surmise that because the person just hoards the money and stashes it away, that they never use the money. And then if they never use the money, then there is no benefit to the owner for having that wealth. And thereby, there's no tangible joy. There's no way to have the pleasure of life that having money should afford a person to be able to have the basic needs met. But it's also perhaps that keeping all the money to yourself, that is brought on by an anxiety of worrying about losing it. Perhaps it could be that they're afraid to ever invest it, or that they might worry that it might be stolen by robbers, or so concerned about it that they take it out and they count it all the time. There's a lot of ways that Solomon could be thinking that having or hoarding money is harmful to a person. I mean, imagine if you had a lot of money and you basically obsessed over it and you counted it every day just to make sure that it was all still there. All of that fretting and all of that worrying about, you know, every little dollar, that's pretty harmful, I think, psychologically to a person. That's no way to live. So by hoarding money, there's an intrinsic harm that Solomon sees comes upon the owner of that wealth. Now, the sixth reason, verse 14, then, so you have a person who hoards all this wealth to themselves, and he says, then, well, that wealth is lost. The wealth is lost through bad business dealings. And if this person who has all this wealth, if he has a son, if he's fathered a son, there's nothing to pass on. He's broke. What Solomon's trying to point out in this problem with wealth is that you might have it, but then you don't. He's addressing the issue of financial security here. A lot of people make wealth an aim in their life, a goal, an objective, something that they just so focused on because they think when they reach a certain point of financial security, then they can just relax and then it'll be there as a cushion, a buffer for them. Solomon's saying that's not true. You might have money one day, and then the next day, you might not. You might make a foolish investment, or you might get robbed. But here, he's basically talking about foolishness, bad business. I mean, the way you handle your money is very important on whether or not you're going to be able to continue having it, or if somebody else is going to have it. There are untold number of stories in the news of people with fortunes, millions, and they waste it. They just don't know what they're doing. They either think that it might be good to give some over here to a certain cause or to try and invest in this property over here, but they don't know what they're doing. Or they just go on a spending, you know, shopping spree. And we're talking like not just the regular shopping spree. We're talking like, you know, exotic car shopping sprees. Where you talk about shopping for condos and you can just have money flying out of your pockets and you can't even count it. There's so many ways that people can lose their money through bad choices. So Solomon's saying here is that the problem with making wealth a goal in your life is that you might be done one day and you might just lose everything. So why are you putting all your eggs in that basket? That's not good to do. That's a dangerous thing. That's a problem with pursuing wealth. All right. And then this idea of losing wealth, you know, it really does kind of harken back to, I think, the story of Job. In the Bible, Job is like one of the epitomes of somebody who had massive wealth and then just lost it all at once through tragic misfortune. In Job, it says that he had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large number of slaves. And he's described as being the greatest man in all the East. But this is what it says about what happened to him and all of his wealth. In Job 1, chapter 1, verse 13, "Now one day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, that a messenger came to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding nearby when the Sabaeans attacked and took them away. Yes, they have struck down the servants with the mouth of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.'" And then it says, "While he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'The fire of God has fallen from heaven and has burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. I alone have escaped to tell you.' And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'The Chaldeans formed three bands,'" you know, three little armies, "'and they swept down on the camels and have taken them away. Yes, and have struck down the servants with the mouth of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you.'" Everything Job had, and then eventually, also he lost his children in a tragic accident as well. All that wealth suddenly vanished. You make your life's goal to get wealth, and then it just suddenly evaporates before your very eyes. That is some really intense disappointment and shock. I think that's what Solomon is trying to warn about the pursuit of wealth, is that you can have wealth and then you might lose it. It may be there one day and not the next. It doesn't offer any security. Lastly, the seventh reason of the problem with pursuing wealth. Well, before I say the seventh reason, in verse 14, he adds on not just the fact that you lost the wealth, he also kind of tags on the disappointment that your family will experience and potentially the hardship that they will go through. He's saying that if the guy had a son, he had family, and he had offspring, there's no inheritance. So the son doesn't have anything now. The money, the wealth just left. And so there's no inheritance to pass on. So if that child was depending upon the inheritance for his livelihood or for some aspect of a business that he was going to start or some leverage that would be of benefit to him, he no longer has it. So the whole idea of trusting in wealth, both from just having it and not having it, but to also for your progeny, for them not to rely on it as well, because if it's gone, you have nothing to give to them and there is no security. Family and generational wealth may be passed down, but sometimes it just vanishes and the next generation starts all over from nothing. All right, the seventh reason is verse 15. "As he came out from his mother's womb, naked will he go again as he came, and he will take nothing. He will take nothing for his labor that he can carry away in his hand." Solomon brings up the ultimate reason, and that's death. You might gain all the money in the world, but when you die, you become broke. All that money means nothing in death. Death will deprive each person of all their wealth. You could be the wealthiest person alive. You could be Musk. You could be Bezos. You could be anybody, Gates. You could be super wealthy. And then when you die, you're just like everybody else, broke. Your money's gone. You don't get to take it with you. As you came into the world, here it says, from your mother's womb, you were naked. You didn't have a penny to your name. When you die, that's exactly the way you're going to be as well. The departure is the same as the arrival, and the arrival as the departure. There's nothing you can take with you that you've labored for. Death will be sure of that. All right, let me show you guys here. These are the seven reasons that Solomon gives for why pursuing wealth as the goal in life, or trying to find meaning or put meaning on wealth that it cannot bear. One, wealth is both addictive and unfulfilling. Two, more wealth just means more people to consume it. Three, wealth doesn't benefit the owner. 4, wealth robs the owner of peace and rest. 5, wealth causes harm to the owner. 6, wealth doesn't provide security. And 7, wealth will disappear at death. Now, there's another evil he sees. There's another grievous evil. This is also a grievous evil, that in the same way that he came, so will he go. This is about being dying and being born. And what profit does he have? Now, this is the question. What profit does he have who labors for the wind? Also, all his days he eats in darkness with much frustration and sickness and anger. This is another grievous evil he sees. This is the question that we've been seeing multiple times now. He brings this back up of what can a person gain? What can a person profit from doing all this work? If you do all this work and you gain all this money, what does it mean? He says, the people that do this, they sit all day and eat in darkness. And this is a metaphor for the misery that a life pursuing wealth will bring. And just the frustration, the sickness, and the anger, all of these things, Solomon is trying to paint such a dismal and bleak picture of a life where the goal is money. Now, after all this negativity, he doesn't leave the reader kind of just hanging there. In the concluding section of chapter 5, he does move back around to a theme that he has brought up and we've addressed at least 2 other times. This was one time in chapter 2, and we see it also in chapter 3. That'd be chapter 2, verses 24 through 26, and chapter 3, verses 12 through 14. What is it that's any good? Is there any good that Solomon can see? And he says, yes, yes, there is. Here's what I have seen to be good. It is appropriate for one to eat and to drink and to see good in all his labor in which he labors under the sun, all the days of his life that God has given him, for this is his portion. Remember that refers to the allotment, what God has assigned to him. This is what he's been given to do in life. Every man also to whom God has given wealth and riches, he's given him power to enjoy them and to accept his portion, his allotment, and to take pleasure in his labor. This is the gift of God. Now, Solomon is trying to say that in all this sort of depressive view on the world, that money is not in and of itself, it's not bad. Especially, he says, when God gives a person wealth and riches, which is different from the self-seeking, oppression-motivated person who tries to achieve and obtain the wealth that they desire because of their greediness. When God gives wealth and riches, he gives the person the power to enjoy what that wealth and what those wealth and riches can offer and provide, not for selfish pleasure and for seeking their own desires and ambitions, but to accept it as his portion to work and to earn money. And that money that God gives, he gives the joy that comes with it, the pleasure of working. This is what God has given to humankind. It is their portion and is a gift from him, Solomon says. And then lastly, in verse 20, for he does not brood much over the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with the joy of his heart. So the person that accepts the gift that God gives him with the money and the joy and ability to enjoy working and being able to eat and drink and see the fruit of their labor, that person doesn't contemplate and think about all the worries and everything else that the rest of the world does, who is striving and running after money as fast as they can. Why? Because God keeps him occupied with the joy of his heart. Solomon views God giving this divine gift of joy for a person who accepts their portion, their allotment, the way that God has ordered the world for men and women to work and then to enjoy what that work can provide. Regardless of everything else, and this is aside from his quest to understand the ultimate meaning of life, he's saying, just considering what wealth can do in the world and how harmful and dangerous and the problems it can bring, there is something good. It's that a person receive the wealth that God gives them and then the ability to enjoy that wealth and the joy in his heart. These are gifts from God. Eat and drink and see the good fruit that comes from hard work in your life. This is the end of chapter 5, and we're going to come back in the next session with chapter 6. Thank you.